Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Few issues today command our attention more than that of climate change, and few people have been tracking it longer or have spent more of their lives trying to understand and form policy to respond to it than Gus Speth. Just an abbreviated list of his environmental posts includes: founder of the Natural Resources Defense Council and World Resources Institute, environmental advisor to Presidents Carter and Clinton, chair of the UN Development Group, and dean of Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. Yet oddly, after a lifetime piled high with such milestones and accomplishments, Speth is most proud of two more modest acts: a letter he penned to the Yale student body in the wake of 9/11, and being arrested in front of the White House in 2011 for protesting the Keystone XL pipeline. In his new book, Angels by the River, a memoir, he recalls not only these public acts, but his childhood in pre-civil rights South Carolina as well. He reflects as much on what isn't in his resume as what is. It is a great pleasure to welcome Gus Speth to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you, Joe.
When you look at your life, at what point did you set out to say, I want to look at the environment, I want to make that my focus?
We were children of the 60s, those of us who went to college and then, in my case, to law school in the 1960s. And when I was finishing law school in 1969, I had to think, what in the world am I going to do with myself now? I've got all these degrees, and sort of casting about. We were, as I say, children of the 60s, so we wanted to do something with a strong public purpose to deal with big problems. And we'd seen the success of the civil rights movement, and I had this idea, well, why don't we create a NAACP legal defense fund for the environment? And that was sort of the epiphany for me. And I was able to get some classmates at law school to join with me in that effort, and a lot of twists and turns, but eventually that became, in 1970, the Natural Resources Defense Council. So it was really a combination of sort of being predisposed on environmental issues by my upbringing, and then seeing this opportunity that was unfolding in the late 1960s to do something powerful on the environment.
Let's talk a little bit before we move on about your upbringing. Brought up in South Carolina, a racially divided town, certainly a part of the civil rights movement and that experience. What impact do you think that had on you growing up?
Well, it was a lovely place to grow up, and I had a wonderful childhood. And the big mark against this this upbringing, of course, was that this town was thoroughly segregated. It was segregated long after the Brown decision. When I left to go to college in 1960, everything was segregated. And it was really only when I went to Yale, went to this Yankee school up north, that I began to see through this cultural baggage that I had inherited and grown up with, and to see the horror and racism of the Jim Crow system. When one's cultural upbringing, you know, sort of crumbles around your feet, it's quite liberating. And it was quite liberating for me, because I realized that I could, you know, I could make up my own mind about a host of things that and question things that I hadn't questioned before. And I think that that kind of cleared the way. And I also, part of that was I decided I really didn't want to get close to the wrong side of history again if I could help it. And so when the environmental issue opened up, it seemed like the next big thing in a way. We had been through the civil rights movement. We'd been through the anti-war movement. And here was this great opportunity to do something wonderful with a law degree, in my case, and to be part of this, you know, exploding environmental movement, which truly exploded between late 1960 and early 1970.
When we talk about climate change today, it often goes back to you and the Council on Environmental Quality and the work done during the Carter years.
Yeah, I think it's important for your listeners to really understand how long we have known about this issue and how long we have known what to do about it. I mean, we put out three, the fourth one in there that we worked on You know, we put out three reports in the Carter administration calling for action to stem the buildup of these greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And we knew a lot. We even put a number on what the tolerable upper level could be, which we'd be fortunate to stop at today. We got a lot of media attention back then. So we've known for 34 years what needed to be done. Anybody who cared to be open-minded about the issue could know, and many, many did know, and we've done nothing.
Talk to me about frustration, because I'm sure frustration has to enter into the equation here. We'll talk a little bit more about it, of where that frustration is now. But at that point, looking back at it, 1979, working in the Carter administration, do you believe something very positive and not easily, but certainly productive, could have been done to reverse what we're seeing now?
I think we had plenty of time back then. We could have phased in things now that we really need to do with great urgency in a more draconian way. And we were, speaking of optimism and pessimism, we were very optimistic back then. I mean, we thought that once, the theory had moved to the point that you could actually see some evidence of climate change, that would be enough, that people of goodwill and good sense would begin to put together the new energy policies and forest policies and other things that were needed. And, of course, that didn't happen. We're now a country awash, quite literally, in the effects of a fairly modest amount of global average warming. I think, you know, this past year is probably the warmest year in the record globally. And we're seeing huge effects already. And so we've been seeing effects of more modest types now for decades. And yet it did not spur the action. And it does lead to frustration. It even leads to anger. I'm furious. I think this is the greatest dereliction of civic responsibility in the history of the Republic. And it's my grandchildren that are, and you know, and other people's grandchildren that are going to take the hit. And there's no way to head off really serious effects. There are ways to head off even worse effects, which is what the battle is all about now.
When you left the Carter administration, you would return to the Clinton administration, as I mentioned in our introduction. In that time, in the 80s, we lost a lot of ground, didn't we?
Oh, we did. We did. I think people have to, those of us of my generation, will remember the cast of characters that came in with Ronald Reagan in 1980. He eventually softened his position on some environmental issues and put decent people in charge of the environment agencies. But for some years there, they were out to destroy environmental programs rather than implement them. And that certainly slowed things up. And in the meanwhile, you know, the environmental bloom sort of went off the rose. The backlash began to gather great strength. And the, you know, the disinformation campaign on some environmental issues, you know, starting with the ozone layer and then moving into the climate issue, the disinformation campaign took real root to the point that, you know, I hate to be partisan because when we started it, the environment was very bipartisan and we had a lot of good Republican action and support. But today, you know, a majority of the Republicans in both houses of Congress are climate deniers or climate skeptics. And they're rushing now to approve this Keystone XL pipeline, for which others were arrested and protesting. And so we've lost tremendous ground politically on the issue. It is so different today than the way it was in the 70s. So very different.
I want to talk in a few moments about the Keystone Pipeline. Let me before we do that, talk about your early excitement about working on the Clinton transition team, working on environmental issues. And you suddenly, rather quickly, learned of the political and media pushback that your work and recommendations were getting, to the point where you ultimately get the call from Senator Al Gore's office, who would be the Vice President of the United States, of course known widely for his environmental work and record, to say, okay, this has to be tempered a bit.
Yes. I was running the transition team, the parts of it that dealt with environment and resources and agriculture and energy. And I thought we were doing a great job putting together the information that the new administration needed. But apparently I hadn't been sufficiently embracing of all the industry groups and others that wanted to participate in this transition also. And But in the end, we had the representatives of the wheat growers and the pork bellies and the chicken farmers and everybody else in our transition team. It worked out all right, but it left some in the new administration with the idea that perhaps I was a little too green to handle. When I realized that, I did one of the, I think wiser things I've ever done, which was to start suggesting to the administration that they send me out of town and to a position that I really coveted at the UN. And that led to a totally new experience for me, going to over 100 countries and then trying to promote the right type of bottom-up, poverty-oriented, sustainable development around the world through our UN program. And I must say it was the most intense and demanding and enlightening experience that I've had, and I just hope I did a good job at it.
Well, it certainly seems that it was a UN development program, and I'm curious as to the balance of looking at that and your work there, saying, what were we doing as a country, what were we doing as a nation, compared to the rest of the world, and that realization that you had all along, but certainly in this case, that we're all in this together and need to do something together.
Well, we've had, I think, a certain amount of hypocrisy in our country about our foreign policy long before the perpetual war that we now seem to be in. We were systematically ignoring international agreements by not joining them. I mean, you look at this long list of global environmental treaties, and the U.S. has joined almost none of them. And the Kyoto Protocol, we never joined. The only one that we really have given any leadership in is the treaty that protects the ozone layer. But all the others, we've been dragging our feet and not joining or not participating. And when all the other advanced countries of the world do participate. So the second thing is that we've been very chintzy when it comes to development assistance internationally. We think we're the most generous country on earth and that kind of thing, but if you look at who's really financing programs, anti-poverty programs and programs to sustain resources around the world, the U.S. is near the bottom of the list as a percentage of what we could be doing, as a percentage of our GDP. In my case, in the U.N., our program got about 80% of its resources from Europe, and only about 10% from the U.S. and about 10% from Japan. So, the U.S. and Europe are about the same size economy, so it gives you a sense of this severe imbalance of Europeans really paying up, so to speak, and supporting the work of the U.N. and the U.S. Not doing it. And for a while there, we weren't paying our dues to the U.N. either, which is a different funding mechanism. So it was a rough time, so to speak, when I was in the U.N. because I was the second highest official in the U.N. and was an American, people expected me to deliver and to bring in a lot of money from the U.S., and I couldn't do it. I wasn't that big a fish in Washington, to say the least, and there was a lot of anti-U.N. animosity at that time. So there were difficult times in terms of the relationship between the U.S. and the U.N. generally. You may remember that when Bob Dole ran for president, he campaigned against the pale blue flag of the U.N., and it was a bad scene in that respect. It was a great scene from the point of view of what we were actually doing around the world, and I take great pride in that, and I wish the U.S. had been more supportive.
Gus Speth is our guest, former dean of the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, founder and president of the World Resources Institute, and co-founder of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Has also been administrator of the UN Development Program, chair of the UN Development Group, professor of law at Georgetown University, and chair of the U.S. Council on Environmental Quality in the Carter administration. We will continue our conversation with Gus Speth after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Gus Speth is our guest. His new book is Angels by the River, a memoir, reflections on race, environment, politics, and living on the front lines of change. The book is published by Chelsea Green. Gus Speth is the founder of the Natural Resources Defense Council and World Resources Institute, environmental advisor to Presidents Carter and Clinton, chair of the UN Development Group, and dean of the Yale Law School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. I do want to ask you, Gus, because I mentioned this in the introduction in our first segment about one of the things that was one of your great accomplishments, and you spoke of it in our last segment, and that is protesting the Keystone Pipeline and being arrested in front of the White House. I want you to talk a little bit about that and why you are proud of that moment, and then put it into context, because here we are, these years later, still dealing with this huge issue.
Right. Well, I was willing to engage in this modest act of civil disobedience because I felt like I personally and the country generally were at the end of our proverbial rope. We have done all the normal things one would try to do for literally decades to get action on the climate issue, and nothing much had happened. So it seemed appropriate. This seemed an appropriate way to draw attention to the issue. And in that first day of protest, I think about 70 of us were swooshed off and put in the central cell block of the D.C. jail for 3 days. Not an inviting experience, but one that we happily went through to make that statement. In the end, there were over 1,000 people arrested, not all of them thrown in jail, but it did start this campaign against Keystone. And the essence of it, I think, is that at the moment that we should be disengaging from fossil fuels, at the moment we should be cutting back in our use of fossil fuels overall, we are in fact going deeper and deeper into more extreme and difficult and expensive types of fossil fuels. And the worst are these tar sands in Canada. So I think it represents the approval of this pipeline, which would facilitate the use of these tar sands on the international market, not really here in the U.S., as is sometimes claimed. It represents a step in a big step in the wrong direction. It's leading us further into the mire when we should be extracting ourselves from it. It's a myth that these tar sands, this oil, this dirty oil, is going to be used anyhow, because this process is being fought all over Canada, and every route that's been proposed for moving more of the tar sands out is opposed vigorously, just as it's opposed here in the U.S. And so I was very happy to hear Obama, our president, say that he was going to veto whatever the Congress said to him on this. And I hope he sticks by that, because it looks like the new Republican-dominated Congress is going to approve, perhaps later this week, the pipeline, even though it's not their job to get involved in this. It's the administration's decision to make a sensible judgment on it. So they're really preempting the administration's decision. Just the opposite of what they're accusing Obama of doing, which is preempting their decision with executive orders. So it's ironic in that respect, too. There's a tremendous volume of very dirty fossil fuel up there. And we know now that we need to leave anywhere from 2/3 to 80% of the fossil resource in the ground. And this is this is going to be one of the biggest issues our country and any country has ever faced. You know, how do we turn away? How do we turn our backs on this huge resource, 80% of the proven reserves, and say no to it? And say no to it because we know that without that, we are going to leave a ruined planet for our grandchildren. That's what we're up against, tremendous economic interest to use this oil, including large investments by the Koch brothers. And I think also there's a huge ideological dimension, because once you recognize that the climate issue is a big threat, you know, you validate the need for strong government action to do something about it. And we have this ideological position among many in the U.S. that basically wants to shrink the government down, as Grover Norquist once said, to shrink it so small it could be drowned in the bathtub. We have a big problem on our hands of dealing with the most crucial issue that I think any society's ever faced. This existential issue of the disruption of the global climate, right in the teeth of a huge economic drive to use more and more fossil fuel, and a huge ideological impediment to doing the right thing about it.
What do you believe is the Republican argument that will resonate, that could resonate with the American people? When you go before voters and say, well, we believe we need this because, especially when all of the news about the environment, when the news about the climate is so dire?
Well, I think people are making very exaggerated claims about what it would do for employment in the U.S. We have some real data on that, but it's not stopping the claims that are being made, probably as we speak, on the Senate floor for the huge number of jobs that will be created, they say, exaggerated. And that's at a time when there is a job shortage, a shortage of good jobs in our country, and people are wages aren't going up, and people are taking part-time work, and there's a lot of hidden unemployment still. And so this resonates with people, and it resonates with some unions, not all. So I think that's one argument that they make that in a grossly exaggerated way. And there's also this myth that somehow it's going to help us with domestic oil production, whereas in fact this material, this tar sands oil, is going to be refined in the U.S., but sold on the open market, on the global market. It's interesting what these very strange low oil prices today are going to do to all of these calculations. This expensive oil that we're getting from fracking and from tar sands and oil shales and things, you know, is being undermined by these very low prices for crude oil. And so this whole energy picture is highly volatile. And, you know, we're in a price war, really, in oil, which is why we're, you know, paying almost $2 a gallon for gasoline. That's cheaper than it was when I was a little boy, I think, if you adjust it for inflation.
When you see New York State come out against fracking, which is a decision that took a long time, but it did happen.
And Vermont.
Do you think that's the trend? Is that where we're trending now when it comes to fracking?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think the opposition is building, and it's fascinating to see a big state like New York make such a decision. You know, the tentacles of the fracking business are running very deep into our land and across the land. I think it's going to be much more seriously affected by these low oil prices than anything else in the near future. By the time the prices go back up, maybe we'll have come to our senses on the climate issue, and we'll be moving away from these extreme forms of fossil fuels. And you know, we really ought to be reducing our emissions from fossil fuels in our country by about 90% by 2050. So this is a huge transformation in our energy system in what is now only 35 years away, and what we invest in today will dramatically affect what we have on the ground 35 years from now. So it's we're already seeing very scary effects from climate change, and we know that there's an inertia in the system that will give us almost as much global warming as we have already experienced, just even if we stopped emitting greenhouse gases. So we bought ourselves a bad situation. We better be facing up to it. So it's something that I feel quite passionately about when I think of young people today. I mean, the predictions are several feet of sea level rise in this century, loss of a huge portion of the total biological endowment of the planet, more severe storms, drier places getting drier and wet places getting wetter, and more storms and heat waves, countries being destabilized, fragile countries around the world because of agriculture effects and effects on water supplies. This is very serious business, and it's the worst crisis we've ever faced. It's one of the tragedies is that it moves rather slowly. It's a slow crisis. It doesn't mean that it's not the most serious, but it's one of the slower ones. And so somehow we've got to find the political muscle to move this process along, and our children's future does depend on it.
So my last question will be a tough one, which is, so where does your optimism lie in that?
Well, I see great things happening in the country, not so much on the climate issue as such, and certainly not at the national and international levels, but we're seeing a lot of communities around the country that are bringing the future into the present in their communities, working for sustainability, working for caring for people in their communities, building new types of enterprises that are public-private hybrids and not-for-profit, profit hybrids, social enterprises, co-ops, credit unions, and new organizations are forming to push us to a new economy. I'm part of something called the New Economy Coalition, which has about 140 members now across the country, organizational members, many of which your listeners will have heard of. And all of these organizations have one thing that they're dedicated to, and that is, how do we move change to deeper levels? How do we change the system, in effect, so that we emerge some point down the road, probably decades, with a new system of political economy that is that's neither the rapacious capitalism that we have today or the old socialism of the past, but it's a new system which really does give, is programmed to give priority to people and to place and to planet. And that's what we need to come together, all of us of good hope and farsightedness, with progressive instincts, come together out of our silos and build the kind of momentum and movement that can lead to these deeper changes that strike at the root causes of today's problems.
Well, the name of the new book is Angels by the River, a memoir. It is published by Chelsea Green. Gus Speth, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and experiences with us.
It's been fun.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Angels by the River, a memoir, published by Chelsea Green. Gus Speth is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.